My name is Sheree and I'm an addict.
Hi, Sheree.
First, I would like to thank the Unity Retreat for asking me to share and for my dear friend Lori for submitting my name. But they've given me the topic of the disease of addiction, not the substance. And the first thing I learned when I came here, my clean date, first of all, is November 23rd of 1987. God willing, in November, I'll have 19 years clean. Due to you guys. You know, I've done some work, so I give myself some credit. But I've done the work through you guys. You know what I mean? My sponsor, my sponsee family, my biological family, and everyone around me who I allow to touch my life. But the topic for me was real simple. They told me when I came around that, you know, it was 10% the chemical and the rest was me. You know, and that just kept it real simple for me. 10% the chemical, and the rest of it was my ideas, my attitudes, my behaviors, and how I perceive them and what I do with them throughout my life. When I came, and I was in this rehab, and I had this fixed idea. Oh, I put down the chemical. Life is going to be just wonderful. Everything is going to be so perfect. I'm going to live in a bed of roses, and nothing's going to go wrong. It didn't dawn on me I still had to pay bills, you know, that I didn't have the money to pay. I still had, you know, at that time I had a husband who I didn't know how to deal with because he was still using. I still had life on life's terms to learn about because I always did it on Sheree's terms, and that's what brought me here, you know, in rooms, in retreats and things of that nature. That's what brought me here, doing things on Sheree's terms. And Sheree's terms was to run. Sheree's terms was to hide. Sheree's terms was to lie. Sheree's terms was to manipulate and con and scheme and steal and all those things that brought me here. So the process for me, I had to get to a point where, okay, now I put down the chemical, how come I'm still crazy? You know, how come I still don't know how to do life? How come I still can't clean my house and get it all done? You know, I could get a room done, maybe two rooms done, but I couldn't get my whole house done, and it was just me. You know what I mean? I was overwhelmed. I was given the tools to clean a house and to cook and to, you know, to take care of a family for which I had none of at that time, you know, other than myself and my husband. And the disease robbed me of that ability to do that. I remember when I went into rehab, it was the day before Thanksgiving, and I've always been a good cook. But the disease robbed me of remembering how to do it. So here I am in rehab, and there's a bunch of us who all came in at the same time, and we had to prepare our own Thanksgiving dinner. I was so overwhelmed. It's like, there's this huge turkey laying there. It's like, okay, what do I do with this? You know, and I couldn't remember what to do with it, but I learned to ask for some help. You know, there were the monitors there, the nurses were there, and all that kind of stuff, and I asked them for some help. And they were like, okay, well, you have to wash the turkey out, blah, 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 blah. You know, you do this, you do that. And we fixed a fabulous meal, and that gave me hope that I could do some things if I just asked for help. I learned very early on that this is a we thing. It's not a me thing. If it wasn't for the we, there wouldn't be me. You know what I mean? Because I believe truly in my heart that a part of me is in all of you. Every time I look at you, I see me. Every time I look at my character defects and your character defects, you see, I'll look at yours too. I see me, you know, and then I have to go back to the mirror. You know, I have to go back to the mirror and I have to look at what Sheree is doing and not focus on what somebody else is doing. See, that's part of my disease. The disease tells me, well, they're lying. Maybe you can still get away with that. She stole. She's 20 years clean and she even shared about stealing. And maybe you can get away with that. But I can't. I remember my ex-husband now going in and out of the fellowship, in and out of the fellowship, and every time he came back, you guys loved him anyway. I didn't think you'd do it for me. So I didn't go back out there. Thank God. You know what I mean? But that's where my mind was. That was my mindset. That was my thinking. That was my disease. I've learned that my disease also is between these two ears. It's big, so sometimes my head is really large. You know, because my disease will run rapid up here. But because of the recovery that I'm gaining and the growing up process that I'm doing, I'm learning to process what's up here versus what comes out of my mouth or what I do with my hands or, you know, my body language or that kind of thing. You know, and that's the recovery part for me. I started working steps. That was the real kicker. That was not in my forte, to read, to write, you know, to deal with emotions and feelings and to actually put it on paper and to for real, I ain't telling nobody nothing. I didn't think you needed to know my business because I found I didn't have no business. Okay, I had nothing, you know, when I came here. I was robbed of everything. And I did learn how to start reading and comprehending. See, I had to comprehend. That's something else the disease took from me. I didn't know how to comprehend things. I could read words, 50 words a minute, whatever, and comprehend nothing. I couldn't remember what I read by the time I got to the next sentence. Okay, so I had to learn to do those things. I had to slow Cherie down, way down, to a point where I had to take a look at, you're reading real well, but you ain't remembering Jack. You know what I mean? And I wasn't. I was remembering nothing. So I had to slow it down. I had to take a sentence at a time sometimes and think about it before I read the next one, you know, and then I started working steps. And the steps aren't about just reading them, writing them, and moving on. The steps are about, you know, doing the reading part, doing the writing part, doing the process with your sponsor part, and then living the part, okay? The first step was hard for me because I was still stuck on that, I can do this, I ain't using no more chemicals. You know, I was on the first step for a very, very, very long time. But back then when I came in, I was kind of like the step a year club. You know, you didn't do a step. I mean, I know people now that are like 6 months clean and are on their 10th step. To me, and this is just my opinion, and I'm allowed to have it because this is my story, that's microwave recovery. You know what I mean? And it's not done on the inside. It just kind of shows up on the outside. But I worked that step, and I couldn't understand why my life was still so unmanageable because I still wanted to control certain things. Okay, I'm giving up the fact that I can't use anymore. But I wasn't giving up the fact that I can't control money. I can't control anything, you know, other than what comes out my mouth and how I perceive myself in other people's eyes, what I do with myself and how you see me. So I was on that step for a while, and then the second step was just as hard, equally as hard, because I was still on that page where my life should be better by now. I'm on the second step. It should be great by now. I don't have insanity in my life. Found out that insanity was, you know, doing the same thing, expecting different results, and I was doing the same thing over and over and over and over, and I just couldn't internalize that I had to do something different. It was internalizing for me that what I was doing is what got me here, and it wasn't working. It just wasn't working, so I had to learn to do things different. No matter how uncomfortable it was, it had to be different for me. So I started doing things different out of fear, and hoping that it would turn out okay. And 99.9% of the time, it was okay. And then I just learned to keep stepping through the fear, slowly but surely. One life on life's term situation at a time. I would step out there on blind faith because y'all gave me that faith. Y'all gave me a God that I couldn't see, I couldn't feel, couldn't touch. And I just believed because I looked at you and you looked a mess. And I said, okay, God is hooking this person up from the inside out. Maybe he'll do that for me. Maybe he'll do that for me. If I let him, he will do that for me. That's where the third step came in. And I started learning to, that's when I started finally getting it, that you ain't got no control. You can't do this by yourself. Give it to a power greater than me. Okay? So I started giving it to you. And I started giving it to my sponsor. And my sponsor quickly told me, you know, I can't be your higher power. I'm just another addict like you. And so I started giving it to, so I started praying. See, I wasn't praying real well up until that point. Till I got to the third step that I wasn't praying real well. And then I figured out, you know what? My higher power's been around here for gazillions of years. And he's handled gazillions of people's problems. What makes me think he can't handle mine? You know what I mean? So I just tried it. I started giving stuff to my higher power and leaving it there. Not forever, just for longer than I was before, you know. And now when I do that, it stays with him much longer. You know, I know it does because my life is peaceful from the inside out. I have two kids, age 13 and age 11. And my 13-year-old's a girl, and she's ADHD. And I struggle with that more than anything in the world, but I give her to God. I do what I can do, and that's get her all the help that I'm supposed to get her. And right now, she's going to eighth grade, and she's a smart kid. She just doesn't have organizational skills. That's typical for an ADHD child. She doesn't have some things that she needs to have, so I have some help. She has a therapeutic support staff. She has a therapist. She has a case manager. She has a behavioral specialist. And I incorporated all these things just this week. I got them all together before school started because I wasn't going to do what I did last year. See, last year, it was nothing for me and my daughter to be doing homework at 1 o'clock in the morning. Because, see, her medication wears off by 5. And if I didn't get her homework done by 5, then it was a struggle. We were fighting. We were battling, and I was forgetting that I was powerless, and I was forgetting that my life was becoming unmanageable and insane because I expected her to do what I wanted her to do. And she would say to me, and it just takes a child, it takes a child to tell you things and keep things real simple, Mom, I'm not perfect, okay? Mom, I can't do this. Mom, can you help me? So I'm learning to do that without snapping. I still get snappy. But I ain't snapping, not at her. But and that's with the help of all these people that are in her life now. She has a support person in school also. I'm very involved in both of my children's education, their mental, their spiritual, their physical well-being. Because that's not what I had. Like I said, I'm doing something different. My mother didn't do that for me. I do it for my children. My son, he's 11. He knows everything. He's a boy. Recently he started, and I just found out this is a boy thing. He was lighting matches. He was lighting stick matches, all those long stick matches that I use for the grill or you'd use for your fireplace or whatever. He's lighting the matches and putting them back in a box. Okay? Back in the box with the other matches. And I was asleep upstairs. My daughter was asleep, and he was downstairs, and he was waiting on the bus to go to summer Bible study. And he got bored. So he started lighting matches, and I didn't even know he was lighting these matches until I went to use the grill a couple days later. It's like, why are all these matches in the matchbox already struck? And, of course, we brought it to the kids' attention. My fiancé and I, we brought it to the kids' attention, and nobody did it. You know, they did it themselves. We have family meetings. That's different for us in my household. We didn't talk about anything. Our family meetings are like this. You can sit down. You can say whatever you need to say. It doesn't matter who likes it or who doesn't like it. We allow you to talk. We allow you to feel. We allow you to express your opinion. And then we all have feedback on it. And if we feel like we're going to get real angry, we sit on our hands. That's what we do. We sit on our hands. When issues come up, this is what we do. And it's been working. It's been working for what, 6-7 months, hon? 6-7 months, and it keeps us from killing each other. It's like working traditions in your house. You know what I'm saying? So we found out that he was striking these matches, and the appropriate consequence that we thought worked, which it did, was, okay, should the house have caught on fire, Mom would have been gone. Kayla would have been gone. Dad was working, so he wouldn't have been gone. And Quincy, you probably would have been gone too. And therefore, that would have left nothing. So you get to play with nothing. Nothing. You don't get your PlayStation. You don't get your DVD player. You don't get your scooter, your Game Boy. You don't get none of that stuff for a week. You know what I mean? So he was pretty miserable, you know, for a week. But he understood why. And he didn't come out of his room. And he didn't cause no trouble other than he had a little attitude. He was a little snappy when I would call him to do something, but that was okay. That was expected. So the other day, both of my children, because they are all both in therapy, my son also, they believe he is suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome. His mother, he's my stepson. His mother has not been a role model in his life. his mother has allowed some things to happen to him that shouldn't have happened to a little boy. So we're working on it. We're trying to work on all this stuff, you know, slowly but surely. We're working on this stuff. This is all different for me. My disease would have said it's her problem. Let her deal with it, okay? It's his mother's problem. It's his father's problem. But his father and I are in a relationship, and we both understand that it's a package deal. You know, we come into the relationship with not only us being damaged, but our children being damaged as well. So slowly but surely, and one day at a time, we try to get the help we need first, get some direction on how to get through the problem. You know, you can't get to a problem unless you go through the problem. You know what I mean? And so we're going through some problems, and it's bringing up some issues, and we're working on it slowly but surely. It's making us better people. It's making our children better people, better little people. You know, but we're all learning, you know, and my disease would not let me do that. My disease would keep saying, this is somebody else's problem. Give it to the therapist and let them deal with it. Don't be involved. Don't go. You know what I mean? But we go. We go. We sit there and we wade through the shit. We just wade through it until we get to the other side. And then we attack another problem. And then another problem. And what's good about it is we can also talk about the good stuff. Because it ain't all bad. You know what I mean? Recovery is great. Recovery is so good for me that my periods of peace and sanity are so wide now. You know what I mean? No longer am I one good day, one, three or four bad days, and another good half a day, and another week of misery. Now I'm having months and months and months of peace and serenity, and I have had months and months and months of peace and serenity. And that's because I'm working the steps. That's because I believe in a power greater than myself. That's because I utilize the we of this fellowship. That's because I have a sponsor who makes me take a look at me. That's because I have the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. That's because I have a personal relationship with my higher power. It's because of all of those things, and only those things, that keeps my life peaceful. Acceptance is the key. I don't know it all. I ain't got it going on. I am almost 19 years away from a chemical. I am not that far away from an idea, an attitude, or a behavior. Because they can pop up. There are things that just kick in for me. I could be watching TV and fear will kick in for me. Or somebody will say something to me, usually somebody that loves me, like my fiance or my children. They'll say something, it'll kick in a nasty behavior in me just like that. But it doesn't mean I have to act out on it. I know the behavior's coming. If I choose to act out on it, you know, that's what's up. I can choose to act out on it if I want to. That would be me letting the disease run my life for that day. If I don't choose to act out on it, that's the recovery kicking in when it's supposed to. So all I can say is I like to keep things short and simple. And I'm about short and simple on this because I didn't necessarily want to do it. But I believe that when I'm asked to do anything in Narcotics Anonymous, I say yes because it's given me so much. I could never, ever repay what Narcotics Anonymous has given me. So this is a little thing, you know, I do it. I don't like to be vulnerable. I don't like to cry in front of people, but I do. And I've learned that it's okay. I've learned that I'm a sensitive person. And if I just start crying at the drop of a hat, it's okay. You know, somebody will understand. Somebody can relate. But don't let the disease get you just for today. Work a program the best of your ability, not what somebody else thinks you should work. If you think they go to a meeting every day is what works for you, then that's what you do. If you've been around here for a minute or you're coming back from a relapse and your life is still pretty full and you can't get to a meeting every day, but you do something in recovery every day, that's what works for you, that's what you do. That's what you do. I still get to about 3 to 4 meetings a week. I still work my steps. I still pray. I still sponsor women who definitely keep me on my toes. I still do what I did when I came here. I still pick up the ashtrays when you're allowed to smoke now. I still put chairs away, and it doesn't have to be my home group. I still clean tables off. I was up there cleaning tables this morning, and they weren't my tables, okay? My daughter said, Mom, that's just the mom in you. Yeah, it is. And it's what kept me clean in the beginning, you know, and it's going to keep me clean today. You know, me cleaning a table when I see that it's dirty, or picking up a napkin, or helping a newcomer, or helping me, or going to my sponsor, or going to somebody in my support group, or doing whatever it is. Because it ain't about just me. It's about all of us. I'm on a page now on what can I do to give it back. You know what I mean? I don't share a lot in meetings. I do a lot of listening because that's where I'm at. You know what I mean? If there's something I need to share, by all means, I kick it up out of there because I don't need it. If you want it and you want to run with it, you welcome to it. Okay? Because once it's up off of me, it don't belong to me anymore. You can have it. Believe me, it caused me some misery. If you want some misery, take it, by all means. You can dance with it and sleep with it and all that if you want to. But it's not mine anymore. You know, so, again, I would like to thank the Laurel Mountain area for asking me to share. I'd like to thank you all for being here. I didn't think anybody was going to be here so early in the morning. And I'd like to thank my sponsor, my sponsee family, my peoples from my area in general. We prayed before, you know, I got here, so it was like, okay, we gave it to a higher power. Not just me, we. I needed us. I didn't need just me. I needed all, because I did pray down there, but I still wasn't feeling real comfortable. And it was like, okay, I need my peoples. Let's pray. Thank you, Michael. But if nobody has told you that they love you today, I do, and I mean that. And thanks for letting me share.
Give Sherry another. And we'll get back. All right, our next speaker is Sean from the, is that the Coatesville?
Williamsport area.
From the Williamsport area of NA. He will also be speaking on the topic of disease of addiction, not the substance. Let's welcome Sean.
How you doing? Addict named Sean.
Sean.
And I thank you for sharing. I really wasn't paying attention too much. My mind was all over the place because I still get nervous. And I remember you from last year when they asked me to share on love or lust.
And, I remember you too.
You know, and that is part of the disease, I guess. You know, love or lust. But I don't know what to share today. I've just been nervous all morning. I've been nervous all night. I didn't really want to share. I didn't want to be the first person to share, to be honest with you. Because I just get clammy, you know. And I had to go to the restroom before I came here, so, you know. There's pancakes or whatever kind of went through you real quick. But anyway... I guess I'll talk about the disease and the disease, not the substance, because that's the topic that they gave me. It's not the topic that I choose, and you know. And I'm grateful, extremely grateful, that they called me and asked me to share again this year. And it's always an honor to come out here in the woods and, you know, spend the weekend with a bunch of people that you love and care about. And even though you don't know them, but you do know them. You know, we all have the disease. And we don't have the substance in our body anymore. And, you know, there's something I want to read before we start. And it came from a format in this this group called Free to Live that's in Pottsville. And every time I went there, I always got these, like, chills down my spine whenever they read this. And it was all out of the basic text. They just took, like, sentence from each chapter, you know. And they put it all in a paragraph, and they decided to put it into a into their format, and they read it before they open up the meeting, you know. So I'm going to read it for you guys because it helped me out a lot. And it talks about the disease, and it talks about addiction. And it says, addiction is a physical, mental, and spiritual disease that affects every area of our lives. The first thing we do for ourselves is to stop using. Any clean addict is a miracle. And keeping that miracle alive is an ongoing process of awareness, surrender, and growth. Our disease involved much more than just using drugs. So our recovery must involve much more than just simple abstinence. NA is like a lifeboat in a sea of isolation, hopelessness, and destructive chaos. We were critically ill, not hopelessly bad. Reaching out is the beginning of the struggle that will set us free. The steps are our solution. They are our survival kit. We do not just say the words of these steps, we learn to live them. By sharing the experience of our recovery with the newcomers, we help ourselves stay clean. This way, we can keep what we have by giving it away. Today, we have a choice. We never have to use again, no matter how we feel. Working the steps and maintaining abstinence gives us a daily reprieve from our self-imposed life sentences. The steps are a new beginning. We become free to live. And when they read that the first time, I thought about my disease. And I thought about where my life was and where it was going. And every time I went to that home group, they would read it, and I would just get these goosebumps. And I'd start thinking about the boat that was out in the sea. And I'm by myself, and I have nowhere to go. And then all of a sudden, you know, all these recovering addicts come by in another boat, and they see me out there by myself, and they throw me a life jacket, and they pull me to safety. And that's what happened to me, you know, is I was pulled to safety. You know, my disease didn't start, and you know, people believe that they were born with the disease. I wasn't born with the disease. You know, that's just my belief. And your belief is your belief, and my belief is my belief. And my sponsor has allowed me to tell you that it's okay to believe what you believe, and it's okay for me to believe what I believe. But the problem comes when I try to force my belief on you, and I try to tell you that you need to believe the way I believe. And we all have our own beliefs. And I've learned that in recovery, that it's okay to stand up for myself, and it's okay to express how I feel, and it's okay to believe what I believe, in spite of if everybody else is wrong in my mind. You know what I'm saying? Because I think a lot of people are wrong in my mind. However, they could be right, you know what I mean? They could be right, but I mean, I'm allowed to believe what I believe. And, you know, I believe I wasn't born with the disease. I believe that just so happens along the way in my life, I started doing things way before I even picked up a drug, you know. I started, you know, it was always about more, the attention, you know. I remember I'd throw chairs across the room in kindergarten. I always, you know, because some little kid said something wrong to me, or I wasn't getting what I wanted, and it was always about me. You know what I mean? It was like I was always searching for that feel good all the way through my life, you know, in kindergarten and first grade and second grade, all the way up, you know, through my whole elementary and middle school years. I was looking for something to fill that void, and I couldn't find it. You know, I couldn't find it at all until I came to Narcotics Anonymous and I found God. And, you know, and I mean, the stuff with, I mean, it, before I used, I mean, it was, if it wasn't, you know, ice cream, if it wasn't candy, if it wasn't more of this, if it wasn't more of that, it was always something. If it wasn't stealing, I mean, stealing didn't start in recovery. I stole before I even used, you know what I mean? I stole, you know, mommy and daddy's cigarettes out of the ashtray because I had seen them smoking it. I stole, you know, my first drink happened when I started stealing the beers out of my stepfather's refrigerator because that's what I thought you were supposed to do. You were supposed to drink, and that's what he did, and that's what I did. And, you know, so my disease didn't start when I picked up the drug, you know what I mean? So it never was about the substance for me. I mean, it's always about the drug, per se, because that's what brought me to Narcotics Anonymous. However, my disease started way before then, you know? And the disease just enabled my using. And it kept rolling like a snowball down a hill. And it kept building. The door was too big, and it couldn't go nowhere. And you know, in my addiction, I mean, I used like everybody else used. My disease was always apparent. I did everything that everybody else did probably in the pavilion here. I stole, cheated, lied, did whatever I could to get to my next one. I do remember little bits and pieces of my life growing up. You know, it was always everybody else's fault. It was never my own. It was always my stepfather's fault because he grabbed me by the throat and hung me out the window when I was 14 years old because he thought I was under the bridge drinking his beers. that's it was his problem, you know what I mean? It was his problem that I you know, did the things that I did, or stole his beer, and, you know, and got an ass whooping for it, or, you know, something like that. It was always his fault, you know, or it was always my mom's fault because she was never there for me growing up. My grandmother was always there for me. It was never my fault, you know, and I didn't learn to look at myself until I got into recovery, that I need to look at me before I look at you, you know, and, you know, in my, I mean, growing up, I mean, it was, like I said, I was always pointing the finger. Well, it was everybody else, you know. I grew up in a family where I was poor. I like to say I lived three lives in one. I was a poor kid growing up and went from a real poor home to a very rich home in a day. You know, I moved in with my dad where he was using all types of drugs, and he was maintaining, and he had a nice house, and he had nice cars, and him and his fiance owned a business, and it was happening, you know. I was getting paid allowance, you know what I mean? I was stealing his car to go cop. I mean, it was the life, you know? And, you know, and going from a poor family to a rich family was like a culture shock, you know what I mean? Like, what do you do when you're poor, you're wearing hand-me-downs, you know, to school? The kids are picking on you at school because you're wearing not Nikes, you know what I mean? You're wearing, like, you know, Kmart shoes, and, you know, you're wearing, like, corduroy pants that weren't even in style, you know? And they're, like, looking at you like you're strange, you know? And so my disease was always to fit in. It was always to belong somewhere. And I never could find a place. And, you know, my life, you know, took a turn. I kept using. You know, things started happening. Overdosed a couple times. But I was always pointing the finger. You know what I mean? Oh, it's my, you know, it's not my fault. You know what I mean? It's not my fault, you know? Well, if I wouldn't have took too much of that damn shit, I probably would have never OD'd, you know what I mean? I mean, I would have never ended up in the hospital with freaking paddles on me if I wouldn't have, you know, took it, you know what I mean? But I just, something just down inside me said, you got to do this, man, you got to do this, and you got to do it, and I kept using until one day I overdosed, and I had no place to go. I was living on the streets. I was 16 years old. My mother couldn't put up with me anymore. My grandmother couldn't put up with me anymore. My family just did not care about me anymore. And I found myself on the street, going from couch to couch to pavilion underneath the pavilions like this. We have an area picnic where I first got clean. And we had the first area picnic underneath the pavilion that I used to sleep under. And, right next to a lagoon, and I slept there because I had no place to go. I did not go to school. I ended up quitting school when I was 16 because I had nothing. And that's the disease for me. That's where it took me. It took me to keep digging a ditch, you know, and I kept digging the ditch. And the more I dug, the deeper I got until I couldn't get out anymore, you know. The last time I used, I overdosed, and I was on, I got arrested somewhere in between there, you know, and they sentenced me to like a 2-year probation sentence. Overdosed, the probation officer gave me a last chance, either you're going to jail or you're going to rehab. There was no, like, okay, now I'll give you one shot, you know what I mean? It was, you're either going to jail or you're going to rehab, and I didn't know what rehab was, I didn't know what detox was, I did not know what Narcotics Anonymous was. All I knew is that I needed to pack my bags and I was leaving Friday morning. And I ended up in a detox and I walked in with a Wise bag. And it didn't have much in it. I think I had a pair of pants, a pair of socks, a shirt. And my grandmother dropped me off there. And I'll never forget the first 2 weeks of detox. It was hell. Talk about the disease talking to you, you know what I mean? The monkey on my back's always telling me, even in recovery today, it's always saying, you know, how about if you just run off of this mountain where it's out in the middle of nowhere, you don't know how the hell to get home, but just keep running, you know what I mean? You'll find something somewhere, you know, leave, get away, you know. And I mean, this shit just kept talking to me. I mean, for the whole time that I was there, I mean, it was like, you don't need to be here, you know. You can go find something. Oh, I know somebody's using in here. You got to find somebody, you know. And And how crazy it was is I walked into the detox, and they put me in the bed for 2 weeks. And I couldn't, I mean, I was suffering from pain in my bones and stuff, but I got up and I managed to smoke 3 packs of cigarettes a day, you know, that I didn't even have money for, but they gave them to me. But I looked in the mirror one day, and I had long, straggly, you know, dirty hair, you know, tie-dye t-shirt, bell-bottoms, socks and sandals, and I looked in the mirror and I said, damn, I look good, you know? And I thought I was going to go find some woman in there to save me, you know what I'm saying? And that's what I did. I tried, I was like writing notes to these women that I thought were like cute and everything and trying to pass them through to everybody to get around and, you know, and next thing you know, I'm sitting down with the counselor and he's saying, what is up with you? You know what I mean? What is your problem? And they confronted me right there, man. It was like life or death, you know, for me. But I didn't know that. I just, you know, I wanted to, obviously you give me a rule book, I would disobey everything. So they in that rehab, the director or whatever, they said, well, hey, how about if we send you to a halfway house? Send me to this halfway house. And I was scared. You know what I mean? I was real scared. I was scared to even be clean. I didn't know what the clean life was about. The things that ran through my mind is like, how can these people dance? How can these people function? How can they not use? You know what I mean? And I realized that my attitudes and my behaviors from that moment in that treatment center was my disease. That the substance was gone. I had to deal with me. I had to deal with Sean now. And Sean didn't like Sean. When I looked in the mirror and I said, damn, I look good, I didn't look good. I was sick. I could see my bones. But the shit in my mind says, damn, you know what I mean? You can do this, you can do that. And I was scared, man, because I didn't know what it was like. And I went to this halfway house, and I was scared to go there because I thought there were a bunch of gay people there. And because when I went to visit, it was nice. I mean, it was like a country club. They had like a hot tub and a pool, and it was nice. I mean, they had Sega Genesis, you know, and satellite TV. It was pretty sweet. There was all guys there, and then, you know, and then all of a sudden, like, two women came along, and it was like this co-ed adolescent halfway house that I went to, but I thought it was, like, funny, you know what I mean? Because people were telling me in rehab, like, you don't want to go there, you know what I mean? That's just a bad place, and you know, telling me all sorts of stories, and I started believing them. But I went there, they gave me Narcotics Anonymous basic text, and that's where I found out about NA, and that's where I really started to learn about my disease and how it affects me in my recovery. You know, and I'm going to talk about that because from that point in that halfway house when I got handed the basic text, my life changed. Had I known it or not, it changed. You know what I mean? We started to go to meetings. Unfortunately, I didn't have the luxury of going to Narcotics Anonymous for my first year of recovery. I just didn't. I didn't have that luxury. I was in a rural area, and we had 7 meetings a week. And you had to go where you had to go. But my sponsor came up to me when we had all these meetings that were starting up 11 months clean, and he said, Sean, you have a choice now. And I made my decision that this is home, and it's been my home, you know. And that's where I started to learn. When I got a sponsor, I got out of that halfway house because I got kicked out. You know, it wasn't like, Sean, it's time for you to leave. It was because I had a disease, and my shit says, you know, well, you can sell cigarettes in here. You know what I mean? Or you can have, you know, they give you this rule. You're not allowed to have money on you. I had all sorts of money on me. They said that you're not allowed to have tobacco products in your room. You're only allowed to have 15 cigarettes a day. I had a stash of them. You're not allowed to do this, 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 and this, but I broke every rule in the place because I, you know, I didn't care. You know what I mean? I just think I was looking for an excuse to throw me out. You know what I mean? So I left there, and my grandmother picked me up, and I called this NA hotline, and that's where I went to my first meeting where I got clean. And I went there, There's people smoking cigarettes, cigars, laughing and carrying on. And I thought to myself, how can these guys laugh, smoke cigars, carry on, and have a life? And I'm sitting here, I'm all angry. I'm looking at people weird. I'm looking like, you know, something's wrong with them. But at that point, when I entered that meeting and I sat down, they gave me Who is an Addict, and they asked me to read it. I stuttered, and they didn't pick on me. And they didn't say, well, you know, you need to leave and you need to come back. You know what I mean? They said, sit down, it's okay, take your time. They had patience with me. Because I stuttered the Who is an Addict. It took me like 5 minutes to read it. And that's where I knew that they cared about me. The meaning of love in Narcotics Anonymous started there for me, you know. And, you know, when you walk into a Narcotics Anonymous meeting and you get a hug and somebody tells you that they love you, that's something. That's something special. I don't know about you, but my dad never told me he loved me growing up. You know what I mean? My mom, she was never there. My grandmother was the only one that ever told me that she loved me. And I went there, and, you know, the disease, I mean, it, you know, tells you all sorts of shit. It's a monkey on your back, man. It's like, you know, these effing people don't care about you. What do you mean, love? You know what I mean? What are you talking about? You know, how can you hug me? I mean, I was scared, you know. When people hugged me, I thought something was wrong with them. I just didn't know. I mean, the only people I hugged were my family, and that wasn't even a hug. That was like a tap on the back type of thing, because I was afraid. I wasn't afraid to let myself go, you know. You know, I mean, the shit says, you know, don't go to meetings. You know what I mean? Just stay home. You know, you don't need to call somebody. But as soon as I left that meeting that night, I called somebody because my stepfather was, I was going to kill him, dude. I just didn't, you know, he kept drinking. He kept carrying on. I couldn't stand him. And I don't know about you, but when you're in early recovery, you can't stand a damn thing, you know. I used to sit across the tables in my meetings for the first year, and I'd give people nasty looks because I thought that they were looking at me strange. I'd just give them a dirty look and like, who are you? And I'd get all cocky with them. And I really learned about my disease when I had 9 months clean. I was at after a business meeting, you know. And, you know, after this business meeting, my home group that I went to, the second meeting that I went to after I got out of this halfway house was a Tuesday night. And I went there, and I'm sitting around the table, you know, and the meeting didn't even start yet. And all of a sudden, these two Italian guys, they start arguing, you know? And I'm thinking, what's up with these guys? They're bickering, battling about this and that with the home group and stuff like that. And next thing you know, one of these Italian guys pick up a chair and whack the other guy, you know? Yeah, true story. I mean, and I'm sitting there, I'm like, damn, you know? This is where I belong. Because that's where I was used to that. I was used to that violence and chaos in my home. I belonged there. I mean, something was right about that meeting, you know? And then they took the guy to the hospital. The meeting went on. And anyway, about 9 months later, I found myself getting in the same situation, almost, in the same meeting. You know, a business meeting going on. After the business meeting, there's this guy and his girlfriend in the kitchen. And I learned about my attitude in my mouth at this point. Is that this guy has cleaned out the coffee pot, and I thought he was talking about me, you know? Because we think people are talking about us and shit when they're talking, you know? And I said to him, he said some shit, and I said, F you, you know what I mean? He says, if you say that again, boy, I'm going to come out there, I'm going to put you on the ground. I said, F you, right? And he storms, man, does Mach 10 and grabs a hold of me and puts me on the floor. I'm like 16 years old, 17, soaking wet, 100 pounds, you know? And the dude's like, oh, man. I'm like, you know, reaching back like I'm going to whale him one, you know? My skinny ass. And I learned at that point that I had an attitude and a behavior problem. And from that point on, you know, I mean, even in... I may be done. Anyway, but... seriously, I had this issue growing up in recovery. I mean, I never realized that when I say something to somebody, it affects them. It hurts them sometimes. You know what I mean? And it just the attitude. I mean, I had 2 years clean, man. I thought I was all that in a bag of chips, you know? It's funny how we have all this slow self-esteem, and a couple years go by in recovery, you get a sponsor and you get some steps, you know, in your life, and you start thinking, man, I'm the shit, you know what I mean? And I'm not the shit, you know? I still have problems in my life. I still go through things, and I still have issues. And, you know, I tell you what, there's days that I drive down the road that I think about running somebody off the road because they cut me off. I mean, that's the shit that goes through my mind. You know what I'm saying? Shit that goes through my mind is like, maybe I need to throw a brick through this dude's window because he pissed me off, you know? I mean, that's the disease talking to me. Well, Sean, it's okay. But then the recovering addict over here on this side is like, no, it's not okay. You know what I mean? And it's like a constant battle. And I'm telling you, you know, I mean, it's not all peaches and candy in recovery. I mean, I went through some things, you know. 11 months clean, my grandmother died. 5 people showed up at that funeral. I didn't ask them to come, they showed up. That's NA love. You know what I mean? When you have attitudes and behaviors and you, you know, start cocking off and throwing an attitude and stuff and they still love you anyway. People still love you and they don't judge you. That's the love that I'm talking about that happens here, you know? Because had it not been for that, I probably would not be here. You know, had it not been for people that loved me in spite of myself, my attitude growing up, I mean, in recovery, because growing up, I mean, I said some things, man, to some people that probably pissed them off, you know. I'm real blunt sometimes, you know, and then I have to think, well, oh, my God, I got to apologize now. You know what I'm saying? And then I start getting this remorse shit, like, man, they're going to be on my damn 8-step, you know. And I got to apologize. And I tell you what, the hardest thing is when you hurt somebody or you say something to somebody that hurts them and you have to go up to them and say, hey, you know what? I apologize, man. I didn't mean that. You know what I mean? And that's the recovering addict working in my life, is that any time I make a wrong mistake, I have to apologize and face myself. And when I face myself, I change, you know. I don't know if I'm done yet, but let me see here. Yeah, I guess I am soon. But anyway, the disease, I mean, it's, you know, it's alive and well inside of me. I can wake the animal up at any time. I mean, I can, you know, I'm just talking stuff that goes through my mind. You know what I mean? Because, I mean, sometimes at work, I don't know. I mean, I work in a high-pressure job. I work, you know, it's constant on the move. It's fast-paced. Things are going on. You know what I mean? And I'm a manager, so I deal with people all day long. And I tell you what, some days, man, some days I just want to, like, walk out of there, throw my hands up. But then there's other days, you know, where I'm, like, all subtle and stuff. There's some days I want to throw people in the trash can. You know what I mean? Because that's just where I go. Do I do that? No. Do I run people off the road? No. The recovering addict in me tells me to apply some steps, say, hey, you know what, Sean? It's not okay to run somebody off the road. It's not okay to, like, burglarize somebody's house because you're poor at this moment in your recovery. I mean, stuff happened in my recovery. I had no job. I mean, at one point in my recovery, I was struggling where I had nothing. I had to go to the food pantry. I mean, that's as low as I've been in recovery, you know? I mean, you got years clean, like 5 years clean, and you're going to the food pantry, that's humbling, man. It's humbling to say, you know what? I need help. You know what I'm saying? And when you start thinking about, like, damn, I could manage if I was using, that's BS too, because I'd never managed. You know what I mean? You start thinking shit like, well, maybe I could steal some meat out of the grocery store. They'll never know. You know what I mean? But then you think, like, 2 seconds later, well, damn, I got to go apologize after that. You know what I mean? And, you know, it's just, my life has been up and down in recovery all around. I've been through a lot of experience that, you know, Some are amazing. I've been through relationship issues. I mean, but I had not used. You know what I mean? I mean, telling you, there was a point in my life I went through a relationship I wanted to blow my head off. And two sponsees of mine walked in the door. Had they not walked in the door, I'd not know what would have happened. But I was determined to kill myself. And two of these sponsees of mine walked in the door and drugged me to a meeting. And that was probably about 4 years ago. And I, you know, ever since then, I mean, my life's changed. I'm getting married next month. You know, stuff's happening. I mean, I tell you what, man, talk about gratitude. I have everything that I ever wanted since I've been clean. I came in here soaking wet, 100 pounds. I mean, you could see my bones in my body. I got a job that people respect me at. I have, you know, I have a boat. I have a house. I have a car. I mean, material things are outnumbered. I have money in the bank. I'm getting married. I mean, things, I mean, there's not much more that you can ask for. I mean, I have a woman that I care about and that I love. I mean, there's things that you can't ask for. They're just given to you. You know what I mean? And to throw it back in God's face, I could do that any time. I could say, I'm done. I'm throwing the towel in. But I don't. And it's because people in here love you in spite of yourself. There's a man that I met. There's a man that I met years ago. He was at a convention and he was sharing about how he hated people. And when he hated people, he hated them because of their disease, because they did things like he had done. And he was pissed off at them for doing the same thing that he done. You know what I mean? Because he cared about them and he loved them. And he used to share about how he didn't like people in early recovery. And it did all he took to just be there for them, you know? And I went up to him afterwards, and he was an older man, about 66, I think, at that time. And I said to him, I said, man, I said, can we talk for a minute, you know? And I sat down, and I said, yo, man, I struggle with the same thing, you know? I said, you're 66, and I was, I think, 20 or 21 at the time, you know? I said, how'd you get through it? He says, let me tell you a story. He says, there was this old man that used to walk down by the beach every morning with a cane. And he used to walk down by the beach, and he had lumbago and arthritis, and his knees, he could barely walk, and he kept walking. And this one morning, he walked down by the beach. You know, the sun was coming up, the waves were coming in, and this one big-ass wave splashed a bunch of fish onto the beach. And this old man with lumbago and arthritis reached down, picked up one of those fish, and threw it back out into the sea. And as he was going down for the second fish, a young man like myself tapped him on the shoulder and said, Pops, why are you always coming down here every morning throwing these fish back out into the sea? I see you every morning doing this. Why? And he said, Son, if one of those fish was you, it'd make all the difference in the world. And I believe that we in Narcotics Anonymous, me, you, everybody here was one of those fish that was plucked back out into the sea. But we can, at any given time, jump back out onto the beach and throw it back in God's face. Thank you.